Accession number 19906, Reel 5.
Well, advance chart Reel 5.
Under the table where we had been placed by the nurses, when we climbed out from under the table, the chief petty officer was still sitting at the head of the table, covered in plaster. He was totally white. He had no idea what had happened at all. And he got part of his hearing back. So you see, it isn't all bad. Occasionally something happens. So they cleaned us up. And to reassure the visitors, they took us all down to the gate rather than visitors come in and see what had actually happened. From there, when they finished with me, they'd done as much as they could with me at the Royal Victoria, they declared me unfit, and I naturally presumed I was going to be discharged from the Navy. But I had. At the time of applying for a change of branch, i.e. the changing over to ordnance from being a gunner, they had approached me about regular service. If you showed any promise, this is what they would do. They said, providing the war is over, etc., would you be interested, you'd like to take on regular service? An unfortunate incident occurred, an altercation between me and an instructor, who was a loathsome sort of individual, which resulted in me in punching the instructor. Not the best of things to do. As a result of that, they looked into my background. They discovered two things. That not only was I underage, I was just 18 by then, so everything was okay, but I was also an engineering apprentice. I should have been in a reserved occupation. I was a very naughty lad. But they overlooked it. What they did, they made me an offer. They said, you can either, as a result of this, what the Master at Arms told me was they wanted to get rid of this instructor in any case, because they considered he wasn't right. It was their opportunity because he was provoking people unnecessarily. You don't go beyond that as an instructor, as I found out in later life when I was an instructor. And they made me a proposition. They said, you can now consider regular time, or we'll discharge you without a mark and you'll be called up straight away by the Army, probably the Pioneer Corps. They said, we'll give you a weekend. And the divisional officer said to me, I've taken the liberty of talking to your father. He doesn't know all of it, but he knows enough. And he said he'd like to talk to you. And they sent me home for the weekend. This is a side to service life that not everyone becomes aware of, but it did happen. It turned out to be a very fortunate circumstance. You will gather I'm a great believer in fate and destiny because of that, and things, other incidents like it. And he persuaded me that it was the right thing to do. He said, you wish to go, what do you want to be? I said, I'd like to do marine engineering if I can. Well, he said, it's not a question of if you can. They'll find out if you've got the capability. He said, and the kind of training they'll give you will be better than anything you can get here. Oh, I listened to his words of wisdom and I did that. Well, that caught up with me when I reported down to Portsmouth after being discharged from Joyce Green. But I was to report to RN Haslar, that's the naval hospital, just behind Gosport, between there and Leon Solent. And I had to go there for a full board, medical board, to see if I was fit enough for sea. And also for acceptance into the regular service. You don't just get in just like that, even then. I was quartered in my old place of headquarters. That was the Coastal Force base at Hornet, where I was victualled aboard, and that's where I slept and where I did various duties, most of which consisted of sweeping up round the guardroom, which didn't appeal to me at all, or going to help the wrens in the galley, which was somewhat better. But most of the time, I was going backwards and forwards to Haslow Hospital for various treatments, still more bits of broken stumps of teeth being taken out, various inspections. And during the course of that, a sister came for me. She said, right, you're to see the chief. The chief? Oh, she said, we call him the chief. He said, he's in charge of all dental operations. When I arrived in his surgery, I sat in the dental chair, she got me ready. I'm glancing round, and on a hat rack or coat rack in the corner was hanging a Rear Admiral's tunic. It turned out he was one of only two in the Navy, and he was a Rear Admiral dental surgeon. Top of the line. And he conducted the examination himself. He listened to me and what had happened to me, and he said, you've applied for regular service. I said, yes, I don't expect I'll get it now, sir. He said, oh, I shouldn't think there'd be any problem. He said, you'll be fit enough. I'll tell you what I'm going to do with you. He said, your gums are in pretty good condition. He said, there's a friend of mine runs a United States Navy dental practice in Portsmouth. You're going over there. He said, which branch are you in? So I told him. He said, what would you like to do? I said, well, I'd hoped if I'm going to stay regular, I'd like eventually to go right through, do marine engineering. I said, I know that entails, by this time I could speak much better, you know. For a long time I couldn't because of the damage up here and something that had launched in my throat at the time. But that all healed nicely. And it transpired. I went across, I got examined by a commander in the US Naval Base over in Portsmouth. Oh, yeah, no problem here, he said. He found out, he said, oh, in Omaha Beach, you know, you guys are in Omaha. You know anybody in the Second Rangers? And I said, yes, sir, I did, actually. I said, we trained with them. Great privilege. Well, it was, because they were good, really good. Anyway, cut a long story short, they provided the teeth. And I ate with those teeth that first day. And to be perfectly truthful, I ate a roast meal in the galley. And it was wonderful. I couldn't believe it because I'd been on nothing but slops, more or less, for months. I mean, a couple of months while all this was going on. And I went back and reported back to the Sortie Admiral again. Right, he said, while you're doing this, this is before I actually got the teeth, I had them fitted and whatnot for trial. He said, I've arranged for you to go over to the courses office in Portsmouth, and you tell them what you want, and you'll show them these letters. And I did about three courses in the time that I was waiting over there, which took me through the branches. It took me, and I became an ordnance artificer because of that. That's what I actually did. You still have to do qualifying time. The Navy doesn't give you anything for nothing. You have to do at least 6 months qualifying time to show that you're capable of carrying out these duties, because many of these duties you will carry out solo. There's no one to help you at sea. You will do it, because you can't just reach round for the nearest garage or something like that. You're going to do it. You're there. So I duly went through all of this, and I was placed on draft. Not fit for what you might call combat service, but I could go take passage at sea. And I got drafted to the Far East, to Sydney, where they had lots of naval personnel joining ships because they were, of course, getting ready to build the Pacific Fleet again. The ship I was assigned to was a cruiser called HMS Newfoundland. She was not at that time in harbour. I think, my memory serves me correctly, she'd gone across to New Zealand. She came back. We, in the meantime, had lost a lot of our kit because due to the mishandling of the dock staff, they dropped a lot of our kit in the harbour. So all of that had to be replaced one way and another. We had an amusing time ashore in Sydney. I was posted to the City Guard in Sydney doing payroll escorts and that sort of thing, because nobody gets away with nothing in the Navy. If you're an available hand, you get the job that's assigned. So we were doing armed guards on payrolls and naval prisoners and whatnot. They had us, what the Americans call a stockade, up near Warwick Farm above Sydney. That's a race course up there. They had quarters and everything else up there, but they also had this prison stockade, and the US Navy had one there as well. There was an awful lot of deserters and whatnot, and used to go up there on these guards, which was quite good. We had quite a time in Sydney, and I lived ashore because what part of the job was looking after naval stores, which they had in strategic depots. Like, they had air bases, mobile naval air bases mounted in lorries. The idea was that wherever they went, they could put down airstrips. The Americans had Seabees and people like that to do it. They all worked together. But eventually, after a few escapes and whatnot in Sydney, and some of them romantic, the Newfoundland arrived and we joined ship. The first operation that we were going to be involved in was some islands. I'm not sure what they were now, but we were in company with an American cruiser. The one that comes into my mind more closely, of course, is the invasion of Okinawa. Now, by this time, of course, I was in what was called general service. I was no longer in the force. I was in D-Day, which came under special service. It was called, I think, the 4th Special Service Brigade, the generic title for all of us people. We had our own units, as I say, like underwater demolition and people like that, but they had an overall command structure. The Newfoundland, we were due to join up with an American force. It was an American heavy cruiser, the Birmingham class, you know, bigger than us, an 8-inch gun cruiser. We hit heavy weather and she was damaged, so we couldn't join up straight away. About another week, I think it was, later, we reformed and we joined up with this, the covering force. Now, the covering force was the bombardment force, and it consisted of American battleships, aircraft carriers, heavy cruisers, and screening force as well to win them. Now, I wasn't watchkeeping. In the Navy, most seamen are in watches, and so are the engine room branches. Most of the other branches, unless you're closed up for action stations, you're not employed all round the clock on fixed watches. You do have duties, yes, but you're working most of the time. Some of you are on standby during the night watches, should you be needed, and you also go up and relieve other people. I used to go down sometimes on the helm position, which in a cruiser is way down, far down, but I wasn't seaman branch anymore. But we came up, we didn't know what the destination was, except that it was an exceptionally large force that were in, what the Americans called a task force. Separate from us was another force which were on the horizon, and they were landing ships and infantry landing ships and an escort, a big heavy escort screen for them. More aircraft carriers and more aircraft. It was towards the early hours, I was asleep, and somebody came and shook me and said, "Come up on the flag bridge, Wally. You're never going to believe this." And went up on the flag bridge, and we were in the middle of a battle fleet. That's a sight that very few sailors have seen since Jutland, I wouldn't think. In all, about 250 odd ships These were all combat ships. None of them were what we called soft. There was another fleet behind us of supply ships of all kinds, ammunition carriers, oilers, the lot. But again, with another escort. Oh, Lord knows how many ships actually were in the entire area. And of course, we joined up, and then just before dawn, we were signalled that cruisers will take the van, which meant you lead the formation. The great honour. We're passing these battleships, about eight of these big American battleships. Well, I'd never seen that many battleships before, certainly not together. I'd been aboard them, I'd worked aboard them, never served in one. And the heavy cruisers and the carriers. And eventually we came up, we made landfall, and then they told us what the target was, that we were going to take Okinawa. And once you took Okinawa, you'd have the basis for a heavy air assault on Japan itself. And that went on once we joined action there. Nothing much happened for about the first 24 hours. Japanese reconnaissance, yes. But once they did come at us, they came at us with everything they had. The first time we'd ever seen or heard anything about kamikazes. And things were exceptionally heavy, very hectic. Ships got lost and went down. Sometimes we got shot up by friendly fire because the Americans would fire at everything. If a torpedo bomber was passing you and they were firing at it, and she was passing with you between them, and they would more often than not hit your funnels and whatnot because they didn't believe it. Unless they saw an aircraft go in the sea, that wasn't down, and they'd learned that by bitter lessons with the Japanese. The Japanese did things with torpedo aircraft that nobody could. Excuse me. But we survived them, and our people, our navigating people, were not fools. Most ships of any consequence have anti-aircraft armament mounted fairly high up. To prevent you from firing too low and hitting your deck, you have stop bars, which will automatically cut the guns off if you try to do that. They overcame that with these torpedo bombers, which were flying exceptionally low, by steering in towards them and causing the ship to roll towards the enemy, which had the effect of allowing you to clear the firing bars. That way, we were able to hit them. The other method was to catch the torpedo bombers with heavier guns when they were further out. The Royal Navy perfected this in the Mediterranean with what they called splash shooting with heavy armament. They'd pick the aircraft up on radar, and the approach for torpedo bombers is some miles out. It has to be, if they get any accuracy. And they would splash shoot them. They'd drop the heavy armament into the water underneath them. The water columns would bring the aircraft down. And that's exactly what we did again. The problem was off Okinawa being able to manoeuvre. If any of the ships were at anchor, they were targets. You had to keep the ship more or less in motion because the Japanese were bombing from all levels, as well as torpedo bombers. This went on, I suppose, gradually fading away for more than a week, as far as I can remember now. We eventually were withdrawn from Okinawa for what was to become the ultimate battle, the landings on Japan. They went all round us, all of us that had landing experience, landing craft experience, and they knew it was no use saying you hadn't. And they also had another purpose, which I was to find out later on. As it turned out, we didn't have to invade Japan. We went in and bombarded the coastline of Japan as designated, but we were withdrawn. We understood there would be multiple landings. The numbers of landing craft totaled something like 80,000, an unbelievable number, even by D-Day 1944 standards. But it would be necessary to overwhelm Japan because of their determination. They'd shown no sign of giving up the fight up until then, even though under heavy bombardment. For several mornings, we'd got used to seeing three aircraft go over. Now, Our radar people told us that they were meteorological aircraft, and undoubtedly they were originally, but they were super fortresses which were coming into use at that time. Eventually we found out what it was, and of course one of them was indeed the one that dropped the first atomic bomb. Now we were ordered to see, we ceased the bombardment and we were ordered to see, I can't remember the distance now, must have been a good distance from the coastline of Japan. And everybody that was allowed on deck was to face away from the land. And it all happened. We saw the flash, even where we were. We were allowed to turn round and we saw this enormous column going up. Now, we must have been considerable distance from land then, but we could see it. And as for the record, the Nagasaki one was dropped later, and which we learned did even more damage. It was a more potent weapon still. We eventually were detailed for landing parties in Japan, and we followed the American ships, including the Missouri, up the inland sea to take the Japanese surrender. On our port side, as we advanced up the inland sea, were Japanese heavy ships. Looked as though they were at anchor, except for one which had turned over on its side. The others were battleships, I think, and one battle cruiser, and they had all sunk. And because the tide was down a bit, it looked as though they were still afloat, but they were actually sunk. They still had the crews aboard, largely, and their ensigns were all down, and all of their armament was trained inland. That done, we were landed at close to Yokohama, and the American Marines went ashore and occupied various buildings and set up bases, and we were under their care. They were looking after us. We took part in the victory parade in Tokyo, and true to his word, Admiral Halsey did indeed ride the Japanese Emperor's white horse at the head of the parade. Japanese were on the streets, but they did their very best to not look at us at all. Some of us, from time to time, were detailed to the Imperial Palace. Every day, the Japanese Emperor was brought out and he was walked through the grounds. He tried to talk to us. We weren't allowed to speak to him. As I understood it, he had some English. He may well have had good English. But we just nodded and said, "Sir," and that was about all. But the Japanese, so many were allowed to see him every day. General MacArthur's headquarters were established in a building called, I think, the Daiichi Building, which is almost opposite the palace. It was a big newspaper building. Every morning he used to enact a little ceremony when the sun was right, when he came out on the steps, and the sun used to strike on the front of his hat, which was smothered in gold braid. He was a show general, but he was also very much respected by his troops, as we understood it. The only people who didn't show any respect were the Australians, who used to turn the corner in a jeep. And as I witnessed one morning, since I was on the palace guard detail that morning, they went straight through his escort in a jeep, cheering loudly. Not very funny, I don't suppose, but there were, that's troops, and that's what happens when wars end and you have people making free. I did more than one tour of duty in Japan, according to whether we were guard ship or whatever we were supposed to be doing. I was detached from the Newfoundland and I served in several other ships for different purposes. Most of them were destroyers. One was a minesweeper. We were detached for duty. The Newfoundland, where I left her, was detached to Shanghai. As a boy, I'd always wanted to go to Shanghai. It was the place to go. The idea of an international settlement, very romantic. It lived up to all of my expectations and more. That's another completely different story.
In what way did it live up to your expectations?
It was wild. There were all kinds of Allied forces stationed in and around Shanghai. There were the Chinese nationalists and the first elements of the Chinese communists who used to indulge in firefights in cinemas and places like that. The International Bar had reopened and some pitched battles got fought there between Allied servicemen of various sorts. And if you had the misfortune to be on shore patrol or detail, you got involved in these things. But I was again detached and joined a mixed force, which was to go to... Oh, just one thing before that happened. The Newfoundland was detailed and took the flag. Admiral Fraser, Sir Bruce Fraser, came aboard, as did Madame Chiang Kai-shek and General Chiang Kai-shek. I can't remember clearly all the details, but at some stage, General Marshall was involved of the United States Army. Now, he was in charge of, as I understand it, lend lease and reparations and things like that. And we were to enact ceremonies at Nanking. Now, the Nanking was the old capital, and is situated up the Yangtze Kiang, which is the Yellow River. Which river changes its course? It's navigable for many hundreds of miles, as I understood it, but no warships had been up there, British, since before the outbreak of the war in the Far East. We had a Chinese river pilot aboard, for what it was worth. The charts obviously weren't much use. And we were in company with two big battle-class destroyers, one of which I served in for other purposes later on. I was detached to her.
Which ship were you in?
The Newfoundland, that's the one. She was a 6-inch gun cruiser, colony class. Unfortunately, we went aground on a sandbar, not far from Rose Island, which... happened, something else happened later on. There was another incident. Eventually, by dint of de-ammunitioning the ship and a lot of stores off her, and by jumping in time to the marine bend on the stern of the Newfoundland, we managed to get her off in the early hours of the morning, during which time both destroyers had gone aground as well and also got off. Because the waters were largely uncharted. We virtually had the sound all the way up. There were a lot of small incidents which took place quite humorously. People did all sorts of strange things while this was going on. The Chinese nationalists got involved with a small tug, and its funnel became entwined in one of the towing hawsers and was plucked unceremoniously out of the tug. And since they were all wearing nice white uniforms, they weren't at all pleased. It being a coal-burning tug, everybody got smothered in coal, or dust, or whatever, and including the British liaison officer who was aboard. Incidentally, we had a Chinese Nationalist Navy liaison officer who spoke excellent English and who thought it was extremely funny on our bridge. However, we eventually reached Nanking and duly did all the ceremonies and were duly thanked by the Chinese and returned to Shanghai. And from there, I was detached. I went aboard... I can't